discuss a little bit. So in terms of the questions that were going around on the group last night, which had to do with conversion, and also Jews, that Rahman al-Islam go so much off the derech that they even convert to another religion. So the basic gist, you know what, let me start with an interesting story that my mom just saw this morning. So some of you know Rabbi Lax, Guru Gil.
Yes, Guru Gil.
So I am Facebook friends with Guru Gil. And he has very interesting posts, of course.
He's this guy that lives in the old city. He's wild. He dresses like...
If you want to know his life story, I have the book at home. But
some guys have... I've never had Shabbos by his Shabbos meal.
Are you never there?
He likes the word Shabbos meal because he doesn't eat meat.
He's not eating meat. Everything's moleks.
So like
he can. Yeah, he has a fascinating life story. That to make a very, 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 very long story very, very, very short, he grew up in a reformed, totally unaffiliated family in Japan, and he ended up becoming a serious hippie in New York, just looking for meaning in life, and he tried everything, and I mean everything. See, he tried drugs, he tried different religions, he tried everything. So he ended up in India, and he turned himself into quite a little guru with his koach of meditation and drew a lot of followers in Central Park, where he was meditating back in New York, and ended up with quite a following. It didn't work out. He ended up becoming a Christian healer, gave up on the Christian healer bit because there were demons in his head, and started just trying to follow the Torah to the best of his ability, since that's where all this seemed to be coming from. So that's how he ended up binding his money to his hand to fulfill the mitzvah of Meister Sheni and going to Yerushalayim because he was following the Bible. The funniest part was when he decides he has to put fringes on his clothes on the corners of his garments. So he goes into the local Oriental laundromat and says, how do I put, what are fringes, how do I make them? So they told him, tassels? He's like, okay, I guess so, tassels. So they showed, I want to make tassels. They put a tassel on all the corners of his clothes, his sleeves. So he said he got to Yerushalayim looking sort of like one of these couch covers. And he davened to the Ribbono Shalom. And he says, okay, God, I'm here. Whatever you send me, that's what I'm going to do. So the guy comes up to him and said, are you Jewish? He says, yeah. He said, you put on tefillin today? The Chabad. Oh, you want to put it on? Yeah. Yeah, you want to go to some Kibrei Tzadikim? Yeah. You want to go to Yeshiva? Yeah. And that's where he's been ever since. So he spends most of his time hanging out at the Kaisel, putting tefillin on people, trying to convince people to marry Jews and whatnot. So this morning, he has a post. Some woman named Anna. So she wrote him a letter. Dearest Rabbi Lax, I hope you are well and your family is well too. I'm so sorry I haven't written you in a while. I was busy digging into my family history, as you told me. I've been so plagued with this emotion that is stronger than a sea current to find the meaning to the deep desire instilled in me to follow Judaism and my love for the Jewish people. Now, clearly, she's not Jewish. I needed answers with evidence, so I decided to dig my family tree. Rabbi, I learned that my great-grandmother was a Jewish woman who migrated from Spain and married my great-grandfather. She died giving birth to my grandmother, and my great-grandfather remarried, and my grandmother, the only child of my great-grandmother, was raised by her stepmother. My grandmother did not practice any Jewish lifestyle, as she was raised by two non-Jewish parents and followed their customs. My grandmother has 8 children, and one is my own mother. They have not had any Jewish influence. My mother became an atheist, and her siblings practiced whatever religion they married into. Rabbi, please tell me, does this mean that I am a Jewish soul? Or because of the lost practice of Judaism from my grandmother, have I lost my Jewish heritage? Deep down, the strong feeling kept leading me to dig deeper on my family history. They may have lost Judaism, but Rabbi, I am very Jewish. I know, I feel this deep down inside of me. Hope to hear from you. Shabbat Shalom, Anna. So he responds to her that basically the bottom line is you have to be able to prove that that's really true. But as long as that's correct, that your mother's mother's mother was Jewish, so then 100%. You are, you're Jewish. I have to tell you, there's a very depressing line in this, because he tells her, go to your local Chabad rabbi or any friendly Orthodox rabbi and ask him to teach you how to follow the commandments. And she responded to that, I'm afraid to go to an Orthodox synagogue because I don't know how to interact. I feel like a stranger with a sad face. But I will go to a Chabad rabbi, as you suggested. That hurts me in my heart. But okay, in any case, very interesting, right? So she dug into her history, and Taka turned out that she actually had, she's really Jewish, it seems like. You have to figure out what's true. All right, whatever. If a case comes up, so then ask your local Shabbat. Maybe your friendly one. Maybe he's not so friendly. Anyway, so what is this story? With at least we'll start with that, and then we can go to the other questions as well. But is there any nafkamina to a Jew that goes so much off the derech that, you know, whatever it is that they end up doing? So I'll tell you the truth. We do have a concept of Yud Gimel Ikarin, the 13 principles of faith. Where does that come from, the 13 principles of faith? Did you see the Torah ever delineate 13 principles of faith? That originated with the Rambam. The Rambam wasn't put them together. It was controversial. Not everyone agrees that there are principles of faith at all. And not everyone agrees that the Rambam's 13 are correct, or that there are at least so many of them, perhaps. Those who agree, so they say there's less. Well, it was controversial times in the Rishonim, generally speaking. All right, so many great controversies from the Rishonim, I guess, that last till today so much anymore. We've passed a lot of things since then. But because of that, there is this idea that there are 13 principles of faith that is pretty mainstream. How many of you here say Yigdal in shul? You have say Yigdal in your shul?
Yes.
Say Yigdal in your shul? Oh. So 4 out of 4? We don't say Yigdal in my shul. Okay, 4 out of 5. Not bad. So that was not my imposition. It's just that's the way it was when I got there. I don't think I would have imposed it. What is Yigdal?
It's the 13 principles.
It is a poetic presentation of the 13 principles of faith. So next time a little kid gets up, there never else is talking through it like it's some insignificant piece of nothing. So you can just remind yourself that these are a recitation of our commitment to the 13 principles of faith. It sounds rather important to me. So it's pretty depressing when you go to these places and people are just talking through it like it's not even important. But in any case, I digress. What does that mean, our principles of faith? And if a person doesn't follow the 13 principles of faith, lamai nafkamina. Like, what does it mean? These are nice things to believe in. You hear what I'm asking? You'd expect, yeah, what do you say?
They're not necessarily explicit in the Torah, but I think the Rambam is trying to say, extrapolates from general ideas that you need to be successful as a Jew, you need to have these.
But I'm asking you, at the end of the day, so if a person rejects one of these 13 principles of faith, so what?
To my understanding, they're pretty, general things, like Moshe Rabbeinu, you have to believe that Moshe Rabbeinu gave the Torah, like, God gave Moshe Rabbeinu the Torah. Like, that's, like, a general, let's get them up, that's like a pretty general thing.
Go for it. You want to get a sitter? Go through it. You have a sitter on your phone?
I have a sitter.
It's in the back of the Archibald, maybe? Is that in the Archibald, that little Chumash right there? The Chumash doesn't have a sitter in the back?
The Chumash doesn't have a sitter in the back?
No, not that one.
It does.
Should be like Shabbat. Yigdal 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 You want a sitter app?
I do have a sitter app.
You have a sitter app? He doesn't have a sitter app. Everyone's got a sitter app.
I actually don't because I didn't like it, so I deleted it. I can't find
my kind of one. You got Rusty Brick one? You tried it?
Which one is it?
It's a little expensive. It's like $10.
Oh, never mind.
Oh. Because it works.
I haven't paid for an app in like 6 years.
I like get what you pay for.
My friend told me that.
My president made one a while back. That's the Rusty Brick one. And then they were hired to make the Archibald one. So they're not, I'm sure that's probably pretty expensive too. But supposedly it's got all their fonts and everything.
Are we another game, Candy Crush?
I've heard of it because people like to post that they're playing it and that they've won. And I've had to block all of notifications from Candy Crush.
I know someone, so Candy Crush basically your 5 lives, whatever you need.
Like, whoa.
There's a pilot to spend money on that app.
It's not really.
People really spend money on that app.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I never tried
that
app, but
I'm
sure.
That's what I thought.
So I know somebody who spent $2,000 on that. He beat the game. He's been 2,000
over how long?
Over like 6 months.
6 months. 1 year, it's like $2,000 on a game. Is he in therapy or something?
But
how much money has he spent?
He's like around $2,000. I don't know.
He really.
Yeah, this is.
Well, I should
see a therapist.
It's not
oh, come on. Does somebody have it already? What's going on? You have it?
It's not here. That's so
oh,
weird.
My goodness. Okay.
It's not here.
So it's all based on, in the back of the Seder, we have the Animamins. That's after Shacharis. Yigdal, of course, is formulated based on them. But it, as I said, it's a poetic formulation of them. And even the Animamins that we have are not exactly the way the Rambam says. There are certain discrepancies between the two. But I don't think we want to go into those details right now. So the basic gist is these are all things that we believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists, number one, that he's not physical, classic Rambam, Lashitaso. Of course, Torah is true, belief in Mashiach, Tchilas HaMeisim, all the fundamentals that we would imagine, that these are the things you have to believe in. But my question to you is, so what happens if a person doesn't? Like, what's at the end of the day, like, what do we do to him?
You don't do anything, it's just
what does it mean they're principles of faith? You know, it's like, these are the Ten Commandments. Well, it's in suggestions. If you want it, you can. You know? You know? What do you mean? They're not suggestions or mitzvahs. So, what does it mean? So, are you ready for this? Buckle your seatbelts, Josh. Ready? Buckle your seatbelt.
I was trying to
figure out what's happening. Anyway, we're all familiar with a certain Mishnah. We're familiar with it because the end of each parak of, or beginning of each parak of Pirkei Avos, it often starts like this: Kol Yisrael, Yeshu Hamchelak, La'olam Habo. Does anybody know where this Mishnah appears?
I'm gonna say. What is it? It's in.
I'll give you a hint. It's in parak Chelak. Kol Yisrael Yeshu Ham Chelak, La'olam Habo. It's called parak Chelak. No.
Nida? Something like
okay,
that.
Okay, you give up. The Perek Chelek is, I think it's the 10th Perek of Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin Perek Chelek is the Perek that deals with like Mashiach and like all the crazy things that you've ever heard. They're all in Perek Chelek. It's full of Agadah.
Can I ask a question?
Is
this what we're getting to?
What?
Hey, this might be what you're getting to. But like, somebody told me, not somebody told me, but like, I've heard multiple times. Like, it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah,
that,
like, about
Olam
HaBa, so, like...
And we're not
going to
deal with that right now, right? But...
Can we deal with that next Sunday? That's, like, a huge question.
No,
next Sunday's
free will.
No.
So, look, Lina, keep track of what you want to talk about, and I'll try to get through whatever we can. We also have next semester for those of you coming back, and we're all coming back here. So,
I'm coming back.
As far as I'm aware, I think there's only one guy in our share that's not planning to come back.
He's going back to Israel, right?
Yeah, go back to Derek. Okay, but what I wanted to tell you was that, of course, that Mishnah says, "Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelik l'olam haba." That all Yisrael have a chelik in olam haba. And then, truth is, the Mishnah goes on to say, "Ve'elu hein she'ein lahem chelik olam haba." These are the people that don't have a chelik in olam haba. So, what does it mean, "Kol Yisrael yesh lahem chelik"? Well, so the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva Perek Yikimol, he seems to indicate to us, as well as other places that we'll go through briefly, that the Rambam seems to indicate that there's something called a shame Yisrael. A name Yisrael. So what does it mean? A person is considered to be a Yisrael. So we, of course, always expect, as Rabbi Lox just said, that once a Jew, always a Jew. As long as the mother is a Jew, we're a religion. If you cease observing the religion, you're not part of the religion anymore. So we're not purely a religion. It's not true. We're also a people. We're also a family. Perhaps we're the only nation. Rabbi Shach likes to say, we're the only Goy that really exists. We say, Shalom, it's not a Goy. But the truth is, we're the only Goy. What? Shach likes to say that if you take a look in Chumash, all of the nations, quote-unquote, of the world are actually families.
Actually what?
Families. Kol mishpachos ha'adama. Mishpachos ha'adama. They're families. So how do you become part of a family? Well, I guess you marry into it, you know, but it goes by the father. Whoever the father is, if he's from Moab, so he raises his children as part of his family. We're Moabites. Ammon, Moab, Amalek, well, whatever the family is going to be, they're families, and therefore it goes by the father. How do I know it goes by the father? Even in Judaism, family goes by the father. How do I know? What goes by the father in Judaism?
What your Israel?
Exactly, the Shevet, your family. But the family has something else going on to it, because we're not just a family, we're a nationality. Now the difference between a family and a nationality is a family, perhaps you can marry in certain ways, but you can't just join a family. It doesn't work like that. But a nation, you can join. can join the nation. And you become part of the nation to such an extent that you are now part of the nation. You want to leave the nation? I'm sorry, you're part of our nation. It's like, you know, you're here. You're here to stay. And you want to forfeit your passport. Okay, you can do whatever you want with your passport, but at the end of the day, you're part of our nation, you're part of our religion. You dump the religion aspect of it, you're still a Jew. So, be that as it may, there is something called a Shem Yisrael, that if a person ceases to identify as a Yisrael, so then he loses certain merit, certain zechuyos of being a Yisrael. That's what the Rambam seems to say. So the teeth, the nafkamina of Yud Gimel Ikari Ha'amuna, the principles of faith, is that if a person doesn't identify as a Yisrael, then he loses his merit as a Yisrael. Kol Yisrael, Yesh Lehen Chelek, La'ilam Habo. So Rachmana Litzlan, it seems like it's possible for a person to lose his Chelek and Olam Habo by disassociating himself with the appropriate belief system of Yisrael. That's a huge chiddush. Whoever heard of that before? But that's what the Rambam would seem to indicate. You take a look, there's a sefer by Rav Moshe Shapiro on this. Re'ei Yamuna, I think it's called. And he points this out, that the Rambam, in his Mishneh Torah, never spells out the 13 principles of faith in that way. What he does is, in Hilchos Tshuva, he talks about problematic people. It's actually in that context of Olam Haba and whatnot, because that's what that's all context and where he gets into it. It makes sense. And that's when he says that there's something called Yisro. Even if you have a total Rasha, they're judged, but they still yeshlem chelak olam haba. Shekol Yisrael yeshlem chelak olam haba. If you want to look it up, I'm reading from Rama Melchot Shuvah Perak Gimel Halacha Hey. Af al pi shechateu, even a Yisrael that does a sin, he still gets his olam haba. Shneimar va'ameich kulam tzadikim. Right, that's the continuation of that Mishnah. The olam Yirshu Eretz. Eretz is a mashal, inheriting the land. The land doesn't mean Eretz Yisrael or some physical place. It is a metaphor, Kolam Eretz Chaim, Vulam Habo. So that pasuk that it quotes in Amishnah of Amich, that your nation is Kulam Tzadikim, Lo'olam Yirshu Aretz, are going to forever inherit the land, it means Olam Habo. So that's how you know, called Yisrael, Yishon Chelkam Habo. V'chein, Chaside Umas O'olam, the Rambam writes explicitly, that the righteous of the non-Jews, Yesh Lehem Chelk Olam Habo, also have a Chelk Olam Habo. But then he says, Ve'elohein, She'ein Lehem Chelk Olam Habo, they're judged, etc., etc., and he deals with them. And he delineates all these different types of people. And Rav Moshe Shapiro spells this out very clearly, that he thinks that you can identify all of the principles of faith by these individuals that don't get their share in Olam Haba. So he argues that the Rambam learns that a Jew who doesn't believe in those principles of faith loses his status as a Yisrael, and the nafkamina is that, Rachmana Litzlan, they would lose their chilek Olam Haba. That's what it seems to come out according to Rambam, certainly according to the way Rav Moshe Shapiro presents it. So, okay, that's a pretty big chiddush. Now, it's scary. Now, what about in terms of their offspring? So, but if they produce a child, so the child is not a Yisrael. So that does not seem to be true at all. So what is true and what is not true? In other words, it seems like a person could lose his chiddush olam habo and doesn't have a shame Yisrael in that sense. But it doesn't mean he ceases to be a Jew, like in this Guru Gil's Anna. So they weren't religious at all. But nonetheless, in terms of her yichus, her lineage, so she's still a Jew. Now the Rambam, Hilchas Avodah Zarah, he writes like this. This is in Perek Sheni, Hilchas Avodah Zarah, Halacha Hey. A Jew that worshipped idolatry. So this would be equivalent of a Jew converting to Christianity. So we could even read it like that. A Jew that converts to Christianity, harehu ka'ovid kachav in the chol devarav, he is like a non-Jew. Ve'enu ke'Yisrael, he's not like a Jew. She'ovir avera she'esh baskila, because if a Jew does an avera, the person gets the punishment of skila. Mumar lavedes kachavim, harehu mumar lachol terakula, because a person who is considered, you know what a mumar is? It's hard to translate, but a mumar means a person who's rejected a mitzvah. Like, he does not on his radar screen at all. It's not an issue for him. He's a mumar for this avera. He'll do it without thinking. Not a problem. So if a person, generally speaking, a person does one particular avera, It's okay. So they get punished for that Avera, or they're what's considered a Mumar for that type of Avera. You can't trust them in that particular area anymore. But the Rambam writes that a person is a Mumar for Avodah Zarah, so then he becomes a Mumar L'Kol HaTorah Kula. He's totally unreliable in any form, in any element or aspect of Jewish law. V'chinah Bikorsim, people have rejected the Torah, not necessarily the drink of Avodah Zarah, but they just rejected things. So Einan Ki Yisrael, L'davar Mina Dvarim, they're not considered Jewish in that sense. V'chinah Mekabel Nesam B'tshuva L'Olam, we don't even allow them to receive their tshuva. Anyway, obviously we know that there is a tshuva. It's just very, very, very challenging. Anyway, the Rambam goes on, in that context. But there again, you see another nafkamina, that when a person, a Jew, Rahman al-Islam, would reject beliefs, particularly, specifically in this case, he's doing avodah zarah, so then he is totally unreliable. And nope. Halach l'maaseh, let's say that a person has a restaurant. So if it's melchiks, it's a little bit easier to do it. But let's say it's fleishiks. So they need a mashgiach on their premises. Who they say? Shomer Shabbos. That's what they'll ask the mashgiachim. I need somebody who's Shomer Shabbos. Why Shomer Shabbos? Because that means a person believes in the Creator. Believes in the Creator. That's how we demonstrate our belief that there was a Creator, and it's the total rejection of Avodah Zarah. So you need a person who's committed to the belief system. Otherwise, he's pashut. He's just not reliable. Not Shomer Shabbos is not reliable. So just one more marimak, actually two more marimakomas to share with you. Okay, so what do we have so far? There is an element of Rahman al-Islam losing Olam Haba. That has to do with the shame Yisrael. And then there's something called reliability in Torah, reliability in Halacha. Right? I'm sure you've all heard this before. Let's say a person who's really not Shomer Shabbos comes to your table, for Shabbos, for Yontif, whatever, and you have your wine, and it's not Mavushal. So that's a problem, because he's considered a non-Jew regarding these Halachas. You got to make sure your wine is mavushal when you have over people who aren't from.
What?
If a non-Jew picks up your wine and moves the wine, that's uncorked, right?
No, I didn't hear that part. I just heard it. A guy comes to your house and you have cold wine on the table, and then it's not uncorked. So I got
confused. Mm-hmm. The Rambam, one more Rambam. And then we'll dump the Rambam for now. The Rambam is what's called Hilchos Mamrim. Hilchos Mamrim are people that rebel against Zakei Mamre, people that go against the Sanhedrin. So the classic Zakei Mamre is like a massive Talmud Chacham, and he is going to disregard what the Sanhedrin says, and because of that, he's going to create tremendous machlokes in Yisrael. Because he's going to have a following, and then he's going to be like, the next Shabtai Tzvi. He's going to split Kalal Yisrael. So that's really, really bad. But in that context, in the third parak, in the very beginning, Rambam writes, Mish in a moed of a Torah Shabal Peh. If a person has simply rejected all of Torah Shebal Peh, ain't a Zakein Mamre, Hamor Batar. That's not what we're talking about, a Zakein Mamre. That's not what it means. Elo, Harezer Bechal HaApikorsin, V'misasa Bechal Adam, that's in brackets. But he's like a total Apikoris, and the Rambam writes that anybody theoretically could kill him. Okay, you gotta figure out the brackets here. The Rambam wrote it, didn't write it, whatever. Me'achar She, Nispanis Shehu Kaifer B'Torah Shebal Peh. After it's clear that this person is totally rejected the Torah Shebal Peh, it's totally allowed to put him in a situation where he could die. In other words, make sure he ends up in a pit, and then you have no responsibility to get him out of there at all. Let him die. He's like all these people that have rejected all these different kinds of things in our belief system. So right over there again. And these people are not considered included in what we call quote-unquote Yisrael. To kill such a person, you don't need Adam and Hasra, Dayanim, judges. That's pretty crazy, because that can be real. Okay, but that's what says. El kol harig echad mehan asa mitzvah gedayla v'hisir hamichshol. So this isn't typical Rambam that you publicize, but the Rambam does write that this is a terrible, terrible disaster for Klal Yisrael when you have these people that are going around in Klal Yisrael identifying as a Jew and preaching that this is not true, and this is not true, and this is not true, and these are the yesodos, the foundations and fundamentals of our religion and our belief system.
So what could be in a modern example of that, do you think?
I don't want to say.
No, I'm interested. Like, I'm serious. Like, there could be these social justice, I guess, Jews that believe certain things that I don't know are necessarily Torah values.
Generally, we assume that that anybody who wasn't raised in a proper Torah family atmosphere, you wouldn't go to a proper Jewish school, this, that, and the other thing. So certainly, these people are defined as what we call Tinok Shenishba, really what we mean by that, I'm sure you learned about this in your class, but really what we mean by that is that Rahman al-Islam, like during the Holocaust, there were children that were taken by non-Jewish families and raised as non-Jews. So they really didn't know that they were Jewish at all. That's called a tinok shenishba, a baby that was captured as a baby. But halacha lemaaseh, Chazon Ish writes that you could treat a person who was raised non-religious as a tinok shenishba in halacha. And therefore, all of these things that we're discussing wouldn't necessarily apply, because we're not talking about a person that's rejected anything. It's just a person that's just unaware of the proper approach. But theoretically, if you really had, you know, a big rabbi and he totally went off the derech and started, you know, really preaching anti, so that theoretically would be a really good problem.
There's no such thing as, like, nowadays, it's very rare to have something along those lines.
I hope so. I don't know.
Also, like, it gets, like, kind of, like, shady when it comes to, like, tinok shel mishpa, because, like, anything kind of that they're taught when they're younger, I guess, that's just not Torah values, and then they go on thinking that is Torah values. When do you draw the line? Meaning, you could have a person that probably learned all the halachos of Shabbos, all the halachos of the Chagim, and then when it comes to a certain hashkafic thing, it has something totally off. Is that considered, do we consider them, how he considers someone, meaning they're just rejecting a sort of the Torah, or meaning they know, I guess, certain things. Like, they might keep Shabbos 100%, but then there's that hashkafic thing.
So you have to see the Rambam's list carefully. You have to see what exactly is considered to be a min, what's considered not bikoris. The Rambam goes through all of them very specifically. It's a rejection of serious beliefs, you know. It's not like, oh, the detail of this, he doesn't understand this and that. It's not like little details. It's that the person really, you know, according to the Rambam, the person's rejected Torah Shavuot, the person's rejected Torah, rejected mitzvahs, insists that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a human being named Jesus, you know. Things like that. So then the Rambam says that that's a serious problem. But most of the time, you don't encounter that. What unfortunately, you do encounter a lot is people who were raised very from and have rejected it. And you find Facebook and Facebook groups and all these kinds of things with people have a lot of commonality amongst them, and they know a lot. They know a lot, and they were raised very, very from. But they were raised with a lot of hostility, anger, abuse, this, that, and the other thing. What do you mean?
First thing, I think that's the wrong way of raising a kid. Like, if the kid doesn't want to be from, and they're like forcing him to do stuff.
Oh, so educationally, you have to discuss, you know, what should a person do in that situation, 100%. I'm certainly not saying that a person should force children to do things when you see that they're rebelling, to figure out how to address them. Correct, 100%.
Yeah, I was thinking about that day. Like, I saw this little kid, he's like 3 years old, and his father is like training him, and like, the kid's doing like these insane things that like even like, you know, guys my age wouldn't be able to do, and like, you know, like strength things and pushing, like running on a treadmill at 3 years old, and like it's just ridiculous. Like I know, but like there's like a point, like how do you know this kid isn't like just brainwashed into the fact that he thinks that he has to be like the best, like gymnast?
Or how he is.
It's ridiculous.
But it's how, let's be honest, it's how the, like the, if the, all the Olympians are like that. They were trained since the age of 1.5 to be able to be masters. Like these gymnasts, you could see videos of them at 1-2 years old doing handstands, getting trained. I know at least two girls in my neighborhood that are like being trained to be gymnasts. They look like gymnasts already. They're 4 years old, they have gymnast bodies. It's the craziest thing ever.
They're already competing. Like,
yeah, there's competitions for 4 years old. There's competitions for 3 year olds.
I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. You know, if parents see certain talents in their children, there's nothing wrong with working on their talents.
Nothing wrong with that.
It's just that if the parents get a sense from the children and the children are not interested in this, and they're pushing the children too hard, and this is becoming something the children are rebelling against, then it becomes a problem. You know, but with children have talents, why shouldn't you encourage their talents? You know.
But I was just saying about, like, how do you know this kid isn't just being forced into doing it? Like,
Well, ask the kid. Do you enjoy it, or is it something that
I
like,
did something on like like a social media site, and like you see it, like you know, it's some Iranian father like pushing into this kid, and like I don't know, like I'm not gonna hold anything against him saying that he's doing this like and forcing the kid, but like you don't know what's behind those videos of the kid's like you know the kid doing this stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. This is kind of like a little bit off topic, but I think it's a huge discussion.
Yeah.
But my question is, how does Judaism deal with homosexuality?
Okay, so that, hold off on that, because let's definitely finish what we're on before
we,
because that really takes us far away.
Can we get something on that though?
Yeah, later. Yeah. Who I was just thinking privately or something. Okay. Yeah, before we get to that, let's finish a little bit of this. So what we said so far is yeah, and then there's nafkamina lahalacha also, that they could be treated like a non-Jew in terms of whatever would be a nafkamina, a non-Jew in terms of wine and whatnot. And the extreme extent of that, says the Rambam, Hilchos Maamarim, is if you really have a person like that, theoretically we would even try to get them killed. And we do not save their lives. So that's pretty terrifying. And like I'm saying, there's a lot of danger, this manazeh, on a lot of Facebook groups and things like that, about people who came from very seriously from backgrounds and know a lot of information and are very much trying to lead people off the derech. And that's this area that we're concerned about. Now, I'm not telling anybody to go kill anybody, but I am saying that this is a big danger to Klal Yisrael. Now, I want to spell out to you a halacha that appears straight up in Shulchan Aruch. So people ask about this, people wonder about this, and you should know that this is a straight up halacha in Shulchan Aruch. In the halacha, this is called Hilchos Geirim. So this is in Simin Reish Samach Ches. It's the very last line in Simin Reish Samach Ches in Yeridaya in Shulchan Aruch. It's a Ramah. The Ramah writes, Yisrael Mumar, Sha'asa Tshuva. So remember Yisrael Mumar, we were talking about a Mumar, right? So he's a Mumar. I mean, he's done a Avodah Zarah, whatever it is. He's converted to Christianity. But now he's done tshuva. Right? So this is one of the questions that was being discussed last night on the group. So Yisrael Mumar sha'asa tshuva. Ein sarich litbo. He doesn't have to do tevila. He does not have to go to the mikveh. Rak midirabbanan. Only dirabbanan. This is interesting. So what did the Rambam just say? He just said that a person that has converted to Christianity should go to the mikveh when he comes back. As part of his tshuva process, he should go to the mikveh. Now, he's saying, it's not because he really is considered to be converting, because there's no such thing as leaving Judaism, but midirabbanan, yesh lo litbo. He should go to the mikveh, midirabbanan. Ula kabbalah lov, divrei, what is this? Chaverus, bifnei shloisha. Whatever, that he should commit himself to Yiddishkeit again in front of three. So it's like a dirabanan de gabezdin that he's sort of like converting back. But don't get confused. So on the one hand, it means that the Rambam is writing beferush in Shulchan Aruch, that midirabanan, if a person really converted to a religion, that's a way, or at least, maybe others, I don't know, so then the person should go to the mikveh in front of three and accept upon himself the mitzvahs again. Nonetheless, don't get confused, chas v'shalom, it doesn't mean that the person is not Jewish anymore. But it does mean that just like we find that a person can, so to speak, lose the Shem Yisrael, so because of that, there's an Indian that when he, so to speak, regains the Shem Yisrael, it should be done in a way that almost looks like a gerus, superficially. So, be aware. That's the Ramon Shachar. Good? Yeah?
Robert, what's the conversion process exactly like a non-Jew?
Basically, a budget test.
You want to know halacha or you want to know lemaisa, what happens?
I guess both, but like, I guess more.
The halacha is mila, tevila, and karba. Mila, tevila, and karba. Now, that doesn't seem to have Kabbalah HaMitzvahs in it, which is, of course, what everyone discusses in this topic. But when Klal Yisrael became Klal Yisrael after Yetzias Mitzrayim, so there was bris mila, either for Korban Pesach or for other reasons, but there was bris mila. And then there was tevila b'mikveh, for Har Sinai, or whatever exactly that was. And there were korbanos, Har Sinai, that were necessary for conversion. Obviously, we don't have a basic mikdash as long as we can't bring korbanos. So it doesn't prevent a person from converting, but it technically would prevent them from eating any korbanos. So if the basic mikdash, when the basic mikdash is rebuilt, so all the people that converted, they would still have to bring their korban before they would be able to be considered Jewish vis-a-vis eating any korbanos. Interesting. But, so nowadays what it ends up being is mikveh alone for women, obviously, and for men, it requires bismillah as well.
My question is, right, when men do mikveh,
yeah,
there's like three guys watching them do it, right?
Okay.
What about when women do it?
By women, what they do is they cover her body, basically. They have a hole in, like, I don't know exactly what they use. It floats in the water. It's plastic. I don't know exactly what the sheet is. But that way, only her head is visible, and they can see that she goes under the water, but they can't see the rest of her body.
Why is it different for women?
It's just not tanua. Because it's in front of a bezin, the bezin has to make sure she has
to
do
it.
So how do you negotiate that it should be with
sneeze? I thought it had to be.
You have to negotiate.
Are women allowed to be witnesses?
Generally speaking, no. It depends on what it is. Some certain categories, sort of, yes. But in generally speaking, no. We don't want women involved in bezin in any way, shape, or form, because we don't want them grilled and we don't want them in that situation. Many explain that as the tamei mitzvahs behind it. But bottom line is that women cannot be dayanim and things like that. So certainly they're not a valid bezin, despite Rabbi Riskin's appointment or whatever exactly he did this bezin.
Okay, do you know anybody you had a full brisk meal?
I don't really know.
Like, I know people converted, but they were circumcised. So what they did was they take a little bit of blood.
Right. I mean, I know in Russia, I know someone that was involved with people that, you know, when they discovered that they needed bris milah, they had to have bris milah. They were Jewish already. They weren't converted. They were actually Jews that just had bris milah. Okay. But you should, I'm telling you, my friend Rabbi Lubarsky, maybe some of you know him from wherever, but he was involved with the Russians, and he told me a story that, like, he was so taken aback or impressed, you know, by these kids, that he sort of, like, approached them sort of with your perspective and said, like, how can you do that, like, you know, and they looked at him with this, like, anger, and they're like, talking about bris milah, you're questioning me. What are you talking about? You have to do bris milah. Like, with such a harif, said, like, of course you have to do it. What kind of question is that? What kind of kofar are you?
Can you, like, be put out if you're doing
it? I think so. I don't think there's a reason why necessarily,
like,
you know.
Wake up with painkillers and stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
It's fine.
I don't think the person has to suffer the pain at the time. Do you need to do? Practically, what it means for a person to convert, it gets a little more complicated than that. Because we don't want people just converting. It's problematic if a person is converting just to get married, because then we suspect they're not really sincere about the conversion. And even though, like I said, the technical three things are mila, tevila, karban, but you have to say there's kabbalas ha-mitzvahs. If a person decides they're going to convert in some, you know, reform manner in which they're not really accepting mitzvahs upon themselves, they're just identifying as a Jew, that's not called converting. That's just called whatever it is, and going through these motions. But let's say it like this, the manner, the method, the mechanisms of conversion are mila, tevila, karban. But the conversion is the acceptance of the mitzvahs. So you can't... There are those that are going to argue, you may hear them in your life, arguing that, you see, the Rambam talks about mila, tevila, and hartzas damim, and karban. But who says you need kabbalas ha-mitzvahs? What do you mean? That's not a conversion. It's not a conversion of kabbalas ha-mitzvahs. The kabbalas ha-mitzvahs is the conversion. The other things are the mechanism in which you enter into the, you know, the bris of being a Jew. But the conversion, of course, is the acceptance of the mitzvahs. So if a person is not accepting the mitzvahs, so then he's not really converting. So that's why there's a big problem with a person that converted reform, conservative, whatever. So it could be that the person is just not aware of what mitzvahs really are, is not aware of what Judaism really is, and then that's not a valid conversion at all. So, you know, we were involved with a person that converted conservative, and eventually she converted Orthodox. And it was a very long process. Because we don't want people, number one, unaware of mitzvahs. Number two problem of Kabbalah HaMitzvahs is that a person may not be accepting the mitzvahs even if they're informed of them, because it's lip service, because they want to marry this wealthy Jew. And who knows? You know, so how do you know that they're really serious? Now, it doesn't mean it wasn't. That's the problem. Because a person could convert to marry somebody, but be totally committed also. So the fact that there's an ulterior motive doesn't prove that the conversion is invalid. That's the problem. So the Rambam has this lashon, like, we're choshesh in lo, like, we suspect, like, We don't necessarily have a mitzvah of a hafta misa ger, because we don't really know really if they're a ger or not, but they converted, they went through the motions. Now, who am I to say that they're not? So you have to sort of like, you know, treat them as if they're Jewish, you know, hoping that they are, and then like, what can you do? Your hands are tied. So we try to avoid those situations because they're super sketchy.
But if somebody converted conservative or reform, let's say,
yeah,
right, on Shabbos, right, if you're going, you can't keep Shabbos, right? You correct. Gotta like do one thing of muktzeh.
Mm-hmm. Well, deraisa probably, yeah.
Turn on the light or something. So that, whatever. So that,
remind me to tell you the story when you're done. Yeah.
So that person who converted right now kind of wants to convert Orthodox. Are they allowed to keep Shabbos?
The answer is yes. I don't think. You know what? I'm not sure. What did she do? Did she do anything? That's so weird. You know, I never thought about it. You know what? I'm not 100% sure. I think that there's those that say that I thought there were those that say that Kosh Shavas Chayav Misa. You know, I'm not sure. I know Rabbi Rapp told me a story that he was involved with a case where there was a woman that she was raised modern Orthodox, and she met a guy, and they were engaged to get married. And so the guy was on an airplane flying wherever he was, I don't remember, and he was sitting next to some chassid or something. So he started schmoozing them. He said, I'm engaged. Oh, Mazel Tov, who's the girl? Where's she from? She's from Poland. Where Poland? Where in Poland? He's talking about Poland. He's like, is she Jewish? The guy got all offended by this chassid. Is he talking? Of course he's Jewish. What kind of, he got really upset. So he, you know, that later night when he got off the plane or whatever, he called his fiance and he said, can you believe this? Chutzpah, this guy's so nasty. I told him you're from Poland. All of a sudden he starts questioning whether you're Jewish or not. She's like, that is so annoying. It's so upsetting. So she went and she complained to her mother. She said, how can you keep believing this guy said that? She's like, the mother's like, well, the truth of the matter is I was going to convert after the war, but never really did or got around to it. She's like, what? So it turns out that this girl's not Jewish.
But that was she keeping, like, here's the thing.
She was modern, she was totally keeping Shabbos, everything.
So she's Jewish.
So she wanted, so she was getting married, like, the
she's
next week.
She's not Jewish.
She's getting married, like, the
she's
next week.
She's not Jewish, but there should be, like, a shortcut.
Yeah, there was. In other words, so she planned on being a Jewish. She didn't want to dump it. And she wants to marry this guy next week. So Rabbi Rapp said, okay, no problem. This is one of those situations where we'll do one of these quickie conversions. It's not like we have to take classes and figure out if you're really sincere or not. Like, you've been raised a Jew your entire life. Obviously, you're committed. You're going to keep it.
The mother?
The mother wasn't interested, I don't think. So, I don't know. I don't know what happened with the mother. So they were going to take her to the mikveh right away. But the problem is, it was that time of the month. So she couldn't go to the mikveh. So they had to wait until whatever, until she stopped bleeding. So the problem is that man had to be over Shabbos. So I think she called up Rabbi Rav or something, and she said, what do I do about keeping Shabbos? So he wasn't sure what to tell her, so he called up, I think, Rav Shachter. And Rav Shachter said she should light a match. So that's what Rabbi Rav told her. She's like, what? I have to light a match on Shabbos? I can't light a match on Shabbos. I don't know. He was saying, I think Rav Shachter was saying that even in the process of the conversion, a person has to be makbid to not keep Shabbos until they convert. Now, if a person converted conservative but did accept the mitzvahs upon themselves, and it really was, you know, kasher v'yasher, it's just not recognized, you know, we were involved in a situation where there was a woman and she converted, and she really planned on keeping to her mitzvahs in, you know, in this conservative fashion, but I think she knew what was correct and what was not correct, al pi halacha. So, you know, hashkafically, maybe there is what to be sketchy, but at the same time, maybe right. It was really valid. So I don't know. That situation becomes much more sketchy. Yeah.
How do people, like, know what it's like to keep Shabbos if they're not supposed to be keeping it then before, like, conversion? Like, that's how
they know. They're not allowed to do this. They know you're not allowed to let them out.
That's why they keep it, and then they, like, turn on the light or something. No. That's the people I know, at least.
Well, you know that story, there were these two chavruzas? There's two chavruzas, and we learned together for like 20 years. And then one says, the other one, you know, I'm making a chasna soon. I'd really like you to be one of the 8-day kiddusha. So the guy says, oh, I can't. You can't. No, I can't do it. I just can't do it. Look at me, can't do it. What's wrong? So he pushed him and pushed him and pushed him. Finally, the guy says, I'm not Jewish.
What do you mean you're not Jewish? We've been covering this for 20 years. What do you mean you're not Jewish? We learned this sugya of Geisha Shabbos Chai. He's like, I love learning Gemara. Why are you learning Gemara if you're not Jewish? It's intellectually, it's so stimulating. But the Geisha Shabbos Chai, Misa, you learned it? He's like, yeah, I'm just like, whatever. He's like, wait a minute. But you keep Shabbos. He's like, no, I don't. What do you mean? Every Shabbos keeps Shabbos. I don't keep Shabbos. How do you not keep Shabbos? He's like, carry every Shabbos. What do you mean carry every Shabbos? Yeah, I have a key in my pocket every Shabbos. Like, key in your pocket? We have an Eruv. I don't hold an Eruv. Okay, whatever. That's the joke. Anyway, I didn't hold an Eruv. But Lamaisa, what happens is that once there's a determination by a Beis Din that this person is really sincere, they really want to keep Torah mitzvahs, so then, you know, the process begins, and then they start educating them, and they have all kinds of tests they have to take, and they have to go in front of the Beis Din, usually more than once, and they ask them questions, and they, you know.
The tests are online.
I don't know, but it's information. You just want to make sure people know what they're doing. You become Jewish, you got to know what you're doing. But it takes a long time, so people are not really serious. They drop out.
You know, there's a problem on Google. If you look it up, maybe it will change. But on Wikipedia, when you search how to become a rabbi, like what are the qualifications, it says nothing about being Jewish.
Okay, there you go. So that is that. So certainly in terms of Jew coming back or whatever, so those are some of the issues that do come up. Good? Okay, before we go to a totally different planet, anything else on this topic?
Did you find out about the pot?
I didn't. I haven't found Rosh Hashanah yet. I keep looking for him.
No, not like pot. Oh, a pot.
Okay, so I guess while we have a few more minutes, so Adam, what do you want to know?
So this is my question. That's because I see so much, I guess, like animosity towards a lot of people, specifically on public forums and in real life. I've seen it. I try to keep my mouth shut when it comes to these things because I don't want to upset anyone.
Right.
So this is my question: does, I guess, Orthodoxy recognize homosexuality to be a, I guess, legitimate, meaning people could actually be homosexual? Then after that, if they do, what are the prescribed things for an Orthodox person to do? If they don't recognize it, why don't they recognize it? And how do you deal with people, I guess, that identify as homosexuals that were raised in Orthodox homes, or modern Orthodox homes, and now are off the derech doing whatever?
Okay, so you'll have to, if I forget one of them, you'll have to remind me.
Yeah.
So starting point is that Torah itself asers behavior, and the question becomes, well, does that prohibition of the behavior necessarily also mean that the orientation is problematic as well? Now, if the orientation is problematic, so what do you do with some of the science, which is not clear, but some of the science suggests that it's not nature-nurture argument, so that it's much more nature than it is nurture. So if it's not something that the assumption is, which is not necessarily correct, the assumption is that if it's a result of nurture, it could be denurtured.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. But the argument also is that if it's nature, then it can't be denatured, which is not necessarily true. Because just because people have certain dispositions, it doesn't mean that people can't train themselves to get out of it. Now, be that as it may, doesn't necessarily mean that anybody's ever going to be able to get out of it either. So how do you know that if a person has a certain orientation that they can become, if you want to call it, deprogrammed or whatever? So that's really not clear. I don't think anybody can say definitively that it's nature, it's nurture, it's a combination, it's whatever. It could be all of the above in different situations. And I don't know that anybody can say definitively that it can be totally, if you want to call it, deprogrammed or whatever you want to call it either. These are things that are very, very unclear. I think anybody honest is going to say that. Now, the question philosophically, how could it be that a Kadosh Baruch Hu, assuming it's nature, how could it be that a Kadosh Baruch Hu will create somebody with a nature that pushes him in the direction of an Avera? So, first of all, Torah never says that the
the orientation is in Aveira. That the Torah does not say. The Torah says that the Maisa is in Aveira. So is that really a problem? So surface answer is that what's the problem? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu created people with a Yetzirah, and then people have Yetzirah for all kinds of things, and then he said you're not allowed to do that. But I have a Yetzirah for that. So okay, so you're not allowed to act on that Yetzirah. But that's not really the problem. Really the problem is that people are bothered by that if this person has such an orientation, it's not like he has a Yetzirah for X. And that so it's that because he has an orientation in a certain way, so then he's never going to be able to get married, he's never going to be able to have a family, he's never going to be able to live a life that's a quote-unquote normal life for a person. So this orientation has way more nafkaminas than your answer is really ever going to be able to answer. Okay, I don't really have anything to say about that. There's also a concept of mamzerus. There's also a concept of things that are beyond people's control. There's unfortunately, there are people that have all sorts of, you know, other issues that they're born with and that they have to live with. It's just, you know, that's the way it is. Why did the Kaddish Baruch Hu do that to this person? I don't know. I don't want to be controversial, but you probably are aware that last week there was a certain popular personality, sort of on the Kiruv scene, that there are a whole bunch of Rabbanim, including one of the Rosh Yeshiva from our Yeshiva, who signed on this document saying that this is ridiculous. How can this guy go saying all these things and we don't appreciate his mahalach and that this is bad? So you'll ask this particular rabbi, and I'm sure he'll give you a straightforward answer. Anybody that's born homosexual probably did something wrong in his last life, and he's brought back to suffer in his life. I don't know. You know, he would say something absurd like that. We don't know. We don't know. This is the way that the person was created, and that's the way that a Kaddish Baruch Hu made it. Is it his orientation? It could be. This is not fair. A Kaddish Baruch Hu, there's all kinds of things that we perceive as not fair. Okay. That's the way it is. People experience all kinds of problems in their life, and okay, we all have to come to grips with our situations. Does that mean now that we can throw out parts of the Torah because we're not comfortable with it anymore? Of course not. The Torah says what the Torah says. Okay, but what do you do with this person that has such an orientation? Okay, so that's a problem. How can he express himself? How can he go weiter? How can he go forward? So, you know, there are those people. You can check it out online, our websites and all kinds of things, Mizman Hazeh, blogs, about people that are Orthodox and they're homosexual and they absolutely refuse to do aveiros. And they live, you know, in an Orthodox world, aware that they have certain orientations, but they're going to follow halacha. They're not saying it's easy, they're not saying, you know, but they say it's possible. So the problem becomes when people identify as having a certain orientation in a way that's trying to be matirit. In other words, when a person says, you know, I'm a proud homosexual, and therefore what? That seriously, and therefore what? And therefore I think that people should understand that there are other people out there that are like that. Okay, people should be more sensitive. Okay. And therefore, you know, it should be okay to be this way, and that should be normal, and then what? So you get a sense that a lot, that it could be, that sometimes when people are going to be open about it in that way, that they're really trying to push an agenda. And the agenda, at the end of the day, is going to be against the Torah, is going to be attacking the Torah, and it's going to be trying to be matir things that are not matirable. So that becomes a real problem. So if you have a person that has an orientation and he's struggling with it, so he's trying to work it out, he should function in the Orthodox world while he has certain things that he simply can't do, despite the fact that he has an orientation in that direction. So that's, I don't think, the type of person that's going to be publicized. But you have a person that's interested in pushing an agenda, so then he's going to be open about it, and he's going to be speaking about it, and he's going to be, but what's the agenda? That becomes the question. What's he trying to do? So the rule generally is that if a person is doing aveiros, it's okay. Everybody does aveiros. In tzaddik bar, it's. So that doesn't mean that the person can't get an aliyah. It doesn't mean that the person is not welcome in the shul. If a person is pushing an agenda that's trying to reject the Torah, that is the type of person that should not be receiving an aliyah and should not be welcome in the same way in shul. So you have to figure out exactly what you're dealing with and who you're dealing with. And that's when it becomes, you know, problematic where we set that line. But it seems to be there are people pushing an agenda and therefore convincing others to do aveiros. That's not acceptable. But then there are people that are suffering, people that are having issues and struggling with aveiros. Okay, there are lots of people struggling with all kinds of aveiros. Right. And then they should be allowed to have aliyahs and they should be allowed to have their place in shul. Yeah.
What about like a
Like, so should a gay person, should, like, let's say he's following halacha because he knows that, you know, and he's trying to fight his temptation, but should he not get married, or should he get married and have children, or
okay.
is it wrong?
So this is complicated. I think we were speaking about this the other day. So it really depends. It really depends. I had a ma'aseh shehaya by me where there's a woman that came to me and she said, I know there's an engagement that just happened. I don't really know the kala, but I know the chazan from my youth, from my past. The guy was an active homosexual. Do I have an obligation to say something to the kala? I was not prepared to take this one on my shoulders.
That's the craziest thing ever.
So I, of course, called my Rebbe, and my Rebbe would not really take this on his shoulders, and he sent me to ask for David Feinstein. So I sent someone to ask for David Feinstein, and his answer was basically that, yeah, she should be told, because this could be a disaster. And it's not fair that, you know, people need to make educated decisions. If you know a piece of information and you're withholding it from someone, so then you're taking away their free will.
What happened?
If they even have free will.
You're taking away their ability to make a decision. So I told this woman, that's what David Feinstein said. So she told this to her aunt, who had set up the shidduch, who freaked out, and went to Rav Asher Weiss in Eretz Yisrael and told him the whole story with, I'm sure, much more information than I knew. I didn't know anything. And Rav Asher Weiss apparently responded, okay, listen, if that's the case, then the kala should not be told. So now I was a little stuck, because I had Rav Feinstein saying that the kala should be told, and Rav Asher Weiss saying that the kala should not be told. So I said to Rav Kahn, what am I supposed to do? So he says, okay, Mistama, more information was presented to Rav Asher Weiss than to Rav Feinstein, because that was the person that actually knew the case. So just let it go and stay out of it. So that's where I kind of ended up. But that was what really brought it to a fore for me personally. That here's a situation where, what's going to be? So you have to be concerned that this is going to be a problematic marriage. But okay, listen, Rav Asher Weiss is saying that this fellow went through whatever he went through, and he, I don't know, whatever he went through, therapy, I don't know what it was. But you should be aware that a homosexual orientation does not always mean that a person has a purely homosexual orientation. I was involved with the
inclinations.
Yeah, I was involved with a person that, you know, watches, like to watch certain things on the internet. He's got all kinds of filters, whatever now, but at the time, but at the same time, he had a girlfriend. So the people have drives, and people have, you know, whatever it is, yitzrei hara in all kinds of ways. But it's not necessarily all or nothing. It's not shy. It's just because a person has somewhat of a homosexual orientation, whatever, that it means that he doesn't like women at all, and etc. It doesn't necessarily mean that. Yeah.
So this is kind of like.
But I don't think we're totally answer the question, right? So the answer to the question at the end of the day is, so yeah, the person really is going to have to make a decision and figure out if it's possible. If this person really is not going to be able to have an acceptable, a proper, you know, a negotiable married life, that's a serious problem. You can't just go ahead and create a marriage where a person's going to not be a proper husband unless the person's aware of this and is willing to work with that. And that's just part of their relationship from the beginning. Yeah.
The next question I'm going to ask is kind of like, it rises out from this, I guess, how this, because like the sexual revolution happened in America in the 70s, I guess homosexuality became more legitimate in America. So do you think it would be beneficial for Jews to have a more, in public life, a more, I guess, religion-oriented public square? Meaning...
What do you mean?
Do you think the church and state should be separated? Or do you think there should be more institutionalized church and state to try to limit the effects of secularism on Jews and such?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the question is getting at. I'm not sure exactly how to answer it either. One of the big issues that's going to become a problem in this direction, if that's what you're referring to, is let's say that somebody comes to me, a homosexual couple, and says, I want you to marry me, and I say no, or am I going to get thrown in jail? You know, I have a right to my religion, I don't have to marry you. Or am I discriminating, and all of a sudden, you know, so that's a problem. So that's what everybody's working on, though. You, and anyone that's involved in politics, is trying to make sure that whatever laws are passed, so there's going to be a certain freedom of religion, in the sense that me, being a rabbi, I'm allowed to stick to my guns and hold by my value system, which may disagree with that, and that, you know, I should be allowed to say no. I should be allowed to, you know, do what I want. If someone wants to get married in my shul, I'm not allowed to say no. I'm discriminating. You know, we have certain values. It's a religious place, so we should be able to follow our religion, and if my religion says it's problematic, I shouldn't have to do it there. So the OU is working on that, and others, Aguda and whoever else is working on these things, to make sure that that's clear and whatever laws get passed. Is that what you're getting at?
Kind of, like that's a good point, but like my main point is, do you think that, I guess, the United States government should have in the back of their minds that I guess there should be certain religious values that we hold, I guess, and that there needs to be kind of a relationship between the public setting and these values. I mean, there should be an understood value system.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Should there be an understood value system in general in the public of America that is religious?
You said it in like an idealistic way, or you're saying in a practical way?
No, in a practical way.
People have all kinds of values. How would you ever come with a common denominator of everyone's value system?
Meaning, let's say, meaning the founding of America was found on certain values.
One of those values is freedom of religion, which means the value of allowing people to follow their religions despite them being disparate.
Yes.
And not having the same value.
Yes, I understand that, but
one of the reasons that Jews have been able to be, Baruch Hashem, so successful in the United States of America is the freedom of religion.
Yes.
Because you're not going to tell me what to do, and you give me the freedom to practice what I want, so we have the freedom to do those things and be from and do what we need to do. And all of those other countries that we've always existed in, where all kinds of values have been imposed upon us, we had to do things in a much more surreptitious way.
Do you think it's, I guess, this goes into the, I guess, constitutional law, but like with the same sex decision in the Supreme Court, isn't it also not fair for a place like Alabama, where 80% of the people don't think it's right, that now they have to accept it in a public setting?
That's a legal question for the United States of America, right?
So do you think that there should be that opportunity for people to have their own self-determination?
I don't know, I have nothing to say about that. You know what I'm saying? When it comes to legal issues of the United States of America, so you have federalism, and you have all these different ways to view, how do you view the states, how do you view the country, how do you view the interaction between the two, how do you view my vote versus everybody else's, That's a massive question that has to do with how to be manhig the United States of America. But I don't know that the Torah specifically has anything to say about that. That's certainly not the way that a Jewish country is going to function.
I heard that there's some rabbis that say you can't vote for certain candidates because they hold certain social issues.
There's definitely a question one would have to ask. I think abortion is a huge one. When the Torah says pretty clearly that abortion is totally prohibited for a non-Jew, it's not technically murder, but it's certainly prohibited for the non-Jew, which means that for them it's a capital crime. So in terms of Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, in terms of how we would relate to non-Jews in that way, so you're not allowed to kill a baby that's, more than 40 days old or whatever it is.
So that's another question I was going to ask. When, can you give me an exact, I guess, generally accepted principle when it comes to abortion? Meaning, can you give me, I guess, what is the orthodox view of abortion? Meaning, when is it allowed? When is it not allowed?
It's definitely a bigger discussion. It's definitely a couple of shiurim for sure to get just the basics.
Really?
But the basic overview is that when in Parshas Noach it says shofeich dam ha'adam ba'adam demoy shofeich, so that's addressed at the non-Jew for Matan Torah, and that they're not allowed to kill a fetus. When is a fetus considered to be a fetus? So for sure, a mistum probably after 40 days. I've heard a little bit other issues from Aaron Lichtenstein. I have notes on this stuff that I have to look at to say precisely. But after 40 days, at least there's a possibility of some kind of fetus. Once a baby is full term and a baby could live outside the mother, so now you have a much bigger shiloh on your hands. Maybe that's considered to be a full life. Maybe that's considered to be murder for everybody. But for a non-Jew, before the baby is totally viable, it seems like that would be not necessarily murder.
With modern science, you could have a baby that's completely...
Yeah, I don't think that's valid, though. That's not called viable. Viable means that if you take the baby out the way it is, it would be able to survive.
So is a person that's on life support not a person anymore?
A person is already no.
Meaning you're saying that if you're taking him off this certain situation, this environment where he's in, is he able to survive? So my question becomes, if there's a person that, God forbid, becomes unviable, meaning if you take out, take him out of this situation,
but they're in opposite directions, because the baby is becoming a life. And until it has achieved a certain threshold, it's not considered to be a full life yet, versus a person who's already alive. And so their life may be, Rahman al-Islam, declining. And the question is, when do they cease to be alive?
So my question is, does it become this? And so let's say baby is technically viable, meaning when you take it outside of the womb, it's a baby,
yeah,
but it just can't survive for more than, I guess, a few hours. But if you were to put it on this life support, it would be able to survive and grow.
But I think that's the difference, is that it's not survival, it's development. That if you have a baby... I could be wrong about this. We have a baby, so the baby needs to continue to develop. So if you take a baby as it is, you know, the lungs probably won't inflate. Like, there's a whole bunch of things that'll happen that it won't be able to develop into the life that it needs to be. On the other hand, there's a certain age, a certain threshold, whatever it is, you know, 5 months, 6 months, whatever it is, that the baby, with, you know, certain help will be able to. So that probably is considered to be viable. But if it's not going to be able to develop... Unless you do all kinds of things and create an artificial...
Exactly.
So then that's... I don't think that's considered viable. You're artificially doing it. I don't see how that could be considered viable.
There's a big law that was just passed in Ohio. It's called the heartbeat law. Where if there's a heartbeat in the fetus, you can't...
Okay.
You can't...
These are all their definitions. That's the problem. You don't have a definition.
Everyone has different definitions.
That's why you need a term.
So the Torah says whatever the baby's viable...
Well,
so that's also
it's in the Tersha Baal Peh. That you need the Tersha Baal Peh for. And of course, that's going to be, you know, a discussion. That's why you have to look at the Rishonim, see how they address these things. But there's a very significant difference in terms of abortion between Jew and non-Jew for that reason. That because it's not considered to be pashut murder until the baby's viable, it seems that that's a capital crime for a non-Jew, but would not be a capital crime for a Jew.
Why is it not a capital crime for a Jew?
Because for a Jew, a capital crime would be murder. But for a non-Jew, stealing is a capital crime.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that's prohibited for the non-Jew is a capital crime, by definition. So that means to say that even though it's not considered to be murder, it would be a capital crime for a non-Jew to do it. But for a Jew, it's not a capital crime, which means there's a certain leeway for the Jew, and there isn't that leeway for the non-Jew. So you end up with a very interesting scenario here, where so we would be much more make for an abortion for a Jew than we would be for a non-Jew. Seems pretty wild, but that seems to be what
comes
out. So then the question just becomes, okay, so let's say that the candidate, one of their many, you know, platforms is that they're a pro-abortion.
Up till the last day.
Whatever. So then does that mean that I'm not allowed to vote for the candidate because they happen to hold of that opinion? I'm not necessarily voting for that particular issue, but it happens to be that that's part of their... portfolio. So, you know, so I don't know. I don't know. I think the assumption is no. The assumption is that you have to take the candidate as a totality. You know, I'm not voting specifically for that position. I'm voting for this person that happens to be one of their positions. I'm not happy about it. But does that mean that I'm not allowed to vote for the candidate because it happens to be one of their positions? I don't know. I don't know if that's true. I can see how one could debate it, but what would be the issue? I mean, misayayin. Misayeh over Avira. I don't know. It's a little bit far removed. I don't know. I understand the argument. I don't know. I'm not sure. Okay. Shikayach. All important topics as usual.
So many topics.
That's what someone has to write a song right now.